A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headache.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. Earlier this month, the State Department issued a fresh Do Not Travel advisory for Iran, even after Iranian airspace partially reopened. That got us a prompt from Daniel about the whole ecosystem of foreign travel advisories.
He's asking us to treat them as open-source intelligence signals. What are the specific factors that trigger an advisory being issued or lifted, and what can the structure and timing of those public announcements tell us about the underlying assessments governments are making?
Why make a message meant for diplomats public, unless you have a secondary purpose? Fun fact. By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V3.2.
I've been wanting to dig into this, because that Iran advisory is a perfect example. On the surface, it's a safety warning. But the subtext is a diplomatic broadcast, especially with the regional tensions we've seen.
Which is exactly why Daniel's question is so sharp. These aren't just bureaucratic bulletins. They're a form of statecraft. They use a public safety framework to send coded messages.
Not just the US, the UK, Canada, Australia. They all have their own systems, their own risk tolerances. Comparing them gives you a mosaic of how different governments view the same threat.
Where do we even start with this? The mechanism seems opaque by design.
We start by dissecting the US system. Since it's the most widely cited, its structure essentially gives us the blueprint. It's the foundational model that many other countries implicitly react to or diverge from.
Right, and that blueprint raises the next question. What exactly is a travel advisory in this intelligence context? It's a public-facing document, not a classified cable, correct?
It's a government's official public assessment of threats to its citizens in a foreign country. The U.S. State Department system is the archetype. They use four distinct levels. Level 1 is exercise normal precautions. Level 2 is exercise increased caution.
Which is vague enough to apply to most places.
It's the baseline hum of international travel risk. Then level 3 is reconsider travel. And level 4, which we just saw with Iran, is do not travel. As of right now, that level 4 applies to 34 countries.
It's not just a level. They attach specific risk indicators. That's where the data gets structured.
Those are the letter codes. To for terrorism, K for kidnapping or hostage taking, U for civil unrest, C for crime, O for other. It's a structured data point. You don't just get do not travel, you get do not travel due to terrorism, kidnapping, and the wrongful detention of U.S. nationals.
Which is what makes it a unique OSINT tool. It's a sanitized public release of what is almost certainly a much more detailed classified assessment. They've taken raw intelligence, run it through a bureaucratic template, and publish the conclusion.
That's the key distinction from something like a NOT, AM, or ship tracking. Those are raw data feeds. An advisory is a finished intelligence product, just one wrapped in a public safety warning. It's the government telling you what it thinks, in a format it can't easily retract, which is why the criteria for each level are so rigorously defined. Take level 4, for example. It isn't just a feeling, there's a threshold. It's issued when there's a greater likelihood of life-threatening risks, when the U.S. government has very limited ability to provide emergency services, or when the security environment is so volatile it could deteriorate with little warning.
Who decides when that threshold is crossed? Is it one person's call?
Far from it. It's a multi-agency process. The Bureau of Consular Affairs at State leads it, but they're pulling from intelligence community reports, diplomatic cables from the embassy on the ground, threat assessments from the regional security officer. There's input from the CIA, the DIA, sometimes even the Pentagon, if there's a military dimension. It's a consensus view. Think of it as a slow-moving committee where everyone has veto power.
Which explains why they're often accused of being overly cautious or slow to change. Getting that many bureaucrats to agree on an escalation is hard. De-escalating is even harder, because no one wants to be the one who lowered the warning right before an incident.
That's the unspoken threshold. The bar for moving from level 4 to level 3 is much higher than the bar for going from 2 to 4. Once you're at Do Not Travel, the burden of proof shifts. You need sustained, verifiable improvement in the security environment, not just a lull. A great analogy is a safety valve on a boiler. It's designed to pop easily under pressure, but resetting it requires the whole system to cool down completely.
It's a ratchet. Easy to crank up, hard to unwind. Which brings us back to the dual-purpose messaging. If this is such a ponderous, consensus-driven product, why release it publicly when the core audience might be your own diplomatic staff? There has to be an external calculus.
Two primary reasons, both signaling. First, by making it public, you're putting the host country on notice. You're formally stating, for the global record, that their territory is unsafe for your citizens. That carries diplomatic weight. It's a rebuke. Second, it signals to other governments and to your own citizens that you are aware of a serious threat. It manages expectations and limits liability. But there's a third, subtler reason. It forces allied governments to coordinate or publicly diverge. When the US puts out a level 4, it puts pressure on the UK and Canada to at least review their stance.
The Iran case study is textbook. The advisory update came in April, even as Iranian airspace was partially reopening for overflight. The wording is stark. It cites the risk of terrorism, civil unrest, kidnapping, and the wrongful detention of U.S. citizens.
Note what it doesn't say. It doesn't mention any specific imminent plot. It's a blanket assessment. That tells you the underlying intelligence isn't about a single event, it's about a persistent structural threat environment. The timing, right after regional flare-ups, broadcasts a continued posture of extreme caution towards the Iranian regime. It's essentially saying the geopolitical temperature hasn't dropped, regardless of airspace logistics.
How does that compare to, say, the UK's advisory for Iran? Is it a carbon copy?
It's a fascinating contrast. The UK Foreign Office also advises against all travel to Iran, but their system is different. They don't use numbered levels, they have avoid all travel and avoid all but essential travel. Their published rationale is similar, risk of arbitrary detention, hostility towards dual nationals. But the tone is often more measured, less legalese. Comparing the two, you see the US framing is more absolute, more final. The UK language sometimes leaves a sliver of ambiguity for essential business. For instance, the UK might have a longer narrative section discussing which groups are particularly at risk, whereas the US entry can read like a list of statutory warnings.
The structure itself is a signal. The US's rigid four-level system broadcasts certainty. Once a box is checked, it's checked. Other systems with more granular or narrative-driven formats can signal nuance or even diplomatic hedging.
And that's why the issuance criteria matter. For the US, slapping a case for kidnapping risk on a country isn't done lightly. It means intelligence confirms a pattern of targeting. When that code appears or disappears, it's a data point, the unclassified echo of a much louder classified conversation, which actually highlights how these advisories vary globally. Take the UK's approach, for example. Their architecture for these advisories is fundamentally different, and that shapes the signal they send.
Give me the architecture tour. Let's go beyond the US and UK.
Their system is famously granular. Instead of just four levels, they publish a map with 11 distinct risk factors. Things like crime, terrorism, health, natural disasters, political stability, each graded on a 4-point scale, exercise normal precaution, exercise a high degree of caution, avoid non-essential travel, and avoid all travel. They update it weekly. It's a dashboard. You can see that, for example, the terrorism risk in a particular province is high, while the crime risk is low. That's a huge amount of structured public data.
Less about a blunt diplomatic statement, more about providing actionable, almost hyper-local risk assessment for travelers. It feels designed for a citizen, not a diplomat.
It's designed for utility first. Australia takes a different path, more plain language, narrative-based alerts. They'll have a level system similar to the U, but the meat is in the detailed description, often with very specific advice about particular neighborhoods or types of transport. They might say, exercise a high degree of caution in Bangkok due to the threat of terrorism and opportunistic crime. Be aware of bag snatching on tuk-tuks in tourist areas. What you see across these variations is a national risk tolerance and a bureaucratic personality on display.
The US system is a sledgehammer for broad diplomacy. Canada's is a scalpel for traveler safety. Australia's is a guidebook. That's a helpful framework.
That has huge practical implications for anyone using these as OSINT. You can't just look at one, you have to correlate. A US advisory shift might be political. A Canadian map update is almost always driven by a verifiable incident or intelligence fragment. So if both move in tandem, that's a powerful signal. But if they diverge, that's equally telling. For a case study, look at Haiti over the past year.
What did we see there?
Moved Haiti to level 4, do not travel, citing kidnapping, crime, civil unrest, and poor healthcare infrastructure. Canada, while also advising against all travel, provided an incredibly detailed breakdown on their interactive map showing that the political instabilities and crime risk indicators were at the highest level for the entire country, but the health and natural disasters risks were at lower levels. That granularity from Canada confirmed the U assessment wasn't just a blanket, everything is bad, but pointed to the specific dominant drivers of the crisis. It added a layer of validation through detail.
The playbook for an analyst is to layer these advisory changes with other open source streams.
The classic triad, watch for travel advisory changes, watch for NOTAMIS, those notices to airmen about airspace restrictions, and watch for any unusual troop or asset movements via satellite imagery or flight tracking. If you see a level 4 advisory issued for a country, and then a week later you see a spike in military transport flights to a nearby base, and then a NOTAM closing a chunk of airspace, you're not connecting random dots anymore. You're seeing a coordinated posture shift.
What's a real-world case of the advisory being the canary, the first visible signal?
Look at China in 2025. There were subtle but noticeable shifts in several Western travel advisories. Not full, do not travel levels, but upgraded cautions about arbitrary enforcement of local laws, risk for foreign businesses, and cybersecurity concerns, right in the middle of very tense trade negotiations. It was a way for those governments to signal concern and apply soft pressure without saying it at the diplomatic table. The advisory was the message. A more dramatic example was the lead-up to the evacuation from Afghanistan. The travel advisories began escalating months in advance, adding specific warnings about kidnapping and terrorism targeting foreigners. Those were the public breadcrumbs leading to the much larger, eventual non-combatant evacuation operation.
The inverse, an advisory lift as an olive branch. That must be rarer.
Germany in 2024 is a clean example. They lifted their long-standing advisory against non-essential travel to parts of coastal Turkey. That followed a period of improved diplomatic dialogue between Berlin and Ankara. It wasn't just that the security situation had magically improved overnight, it was a political decision to normalize relations, communicated through the travel advisory channel. It's a signaling game. The host country reads these too. When the US issues a level 4, Iran's foreign ministry inevitably condemns it as propaganda. They're reading the signal loud and clear.
It becomes a form of slow motion, public diplomacy, a way to escalate or de-escalate tensions without having a diplomat shout at a press conference.
And that's the second-order insight. The contents of the advisory tells you about the threat. The eye timing and the stylistic choices tell you about the relationship. A sudden, unannounced escalation to level 4 with harsh, specific language? That's a sharp diplomatic rebuke. A gradual, coordinated downgrade among allies? That's a thaw. The advisory is the text, but the metadata, the when and the how, is the subtext. So if you're looking to apply this, the first question is, what's the playbook for reading those signals?
That's exactly where I was headed. For someone who wants to add this to their toolkit, where do they even start? What's the practical playbook? Assume I'm an analyst with a watch list of 5 countries.
First, you need to monitor the sources. Bookmark the U.S. State Department's Travel Advisory page. For comparison, keep tabs on the U.K. Foreign Office, Canada's Travel Advice and Advisory site, and Australia's Smart Traveller. They all have email alert subscriptions or RSS feeds. Set them up for your countries of interest. Don't just check for level changes, check for any text updates, even if the level stays the same.
When you see an update, the first thing to parse is the specific language, not just the level. What are the key phrases to hunt for?
Look for escalators in the text. Phrases like mandatory departure or authorized departure for non-essential embassy staff is a massive red flag. It means they're actively pulling people out. Voluntary departure is a step down, but still serious. Also watch for new risk codes being added. If a K for kidnapping suddenly appears on a country that didn't have it before, that's a concrete intelligence indicator now being acknowledged publicly. Another big one is the expansion of geographic scope. If an advisory that previously applied to a border region is suddenly expanded to cover the entire country.
What about the downgrades? They're rarer, so how do you read them?
When a level 4 drops to a level 3, read the justification carefully. Is it citing improved securities or successful counterterrorism operations? That suggests an intelligence-based decision. Or is it more hedged, like some areas show stabilities? Or while risks remain, the capacity of local authorities has improved? The latter strongly suggests a political decision, not a full intelligence, all clear. It's a diplomatic opening.
The analyst's move is to correlate. You see a shift, you immediately check for NOTAMs in that region, any embassy alerts, and maybe commercial flight cancellations. What's the first data layer you cross-reference?
That's the workflow. Layer the advisory change with other open source streams. My first stop is often flight tracking. If Canada suddenly adds a high terrorism risk to a specific province, I'll cross-reference with local news from that region and any changes in police or military posture I can find via social media or local reporting. I'll also check if any airlines have suspended routes. The advisory is your trigger to go looking for the supporting evidence. It's the official headline. Your job is to find the story in the data streams.
For comparing across governments, you're looking for divergence as much as consensus. That discrepancy tells its own story.
If the U.S. goes to level 4, but the U.K. stays at a void all but essential travel, that discrepancy is itself a data point. It tells you about differing intelligence assessments, or more likely, differing diplomatic appetites for sending a harsh signal. Maybe the U.K. has more essential commercial interests on the ground they're trying to protect. That gap is where the interesting analysis lives. Another fun fact, during the early days of the Ukraine conflict, the U.S. advisories for Russia were closely aligned. But several other European countries were slower to escalate to the highest level, reflecting their more complex, entangled relationships with Moscow. The key is to treat these not as boring government bulletins, but as structured data releases. They're slow-moving, but they have official weight. In the noise of real-time alerts and social media hype, an advisory change is a deliberate, vetted signal from the heart of a government security apparatus. It's worth building a watch list for a handful of countries you're tracking, because that deliberate pace is exactly what creates meaningful divergence from the noise.
That divergence is the friction that creates insight. Which leads me to a final open question. As this whole field gets more data-driven, what happens when these advisories are, say, partly generated by AI? Does that change the signaling game? Could we see real-time advisories?
That's a fascinating frontier. Imagine a system that ingests thousands of local news reports, crime statistics, even social media sentiment, and suggests advisory updates. It could make them more responsive, but also more volatile. The diplomatic subtext that carefully crafted rebuke or thaw might get lost in the algorithm. Or worse, an automated system could inadvertently escalate based on a data spike that humans would contextualize, like a single, isolated protests getting misclassified as nationwide civil unrest.
The nuance we've been digging for could get flattened by efficiency. Or, conversely, an AI. I might spot patterns humans miss, like a gradual increase in reports of petty crime targeting tourists in a specific district that presages a larger organized crime wave, creating a whole new layer of subtle signaling we don't even know how to read yet. The signals are only going to get more granular and more frequent as geopolitical tensions themselves become more networked.
This isn't a static discipline. The tools for reading the map are evolving as fast as the map itself, which is why.
This episode was produced using DeepSeek V3.2. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.